This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with film director Friedrich Moser about his new film, A Good American.
The good American in question is Bill Binney, who had developed a viable alternative to mass surveillance, which was nixed.
We'll talk with attorneys about the recent settlement in Stephen Salida's case against the University of Illinois.
When Salida was fired, a huge number of academics and Palestinian solidarity activists rallied behind him. He got excellent legal help, and just 2 weeks ago, his case was settled. A big victory for Palestine solidarity movement.
We'll listen to some live interviews from the Coalition of Immokalee Workers' recent action in New York City against Wendy's.
There was a demonstration in front of Wendy's on 45th Street, and then a march over to the board meeting to try to get Wendy's to sign a fair food agreement with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Weeks before the September 11th attacks, newly arrived NSA Director General Michael Hayden nixed a highly effective computer surveillance program called ThinThread. Hayden instead elected to award a $280 million contract to the private Science Applications International Corporation to develop Trailblazer, a program that ultimately cost billions of dollars and that was deemed by anonymous NSA sources as a, quote, wasteful failure before it was finally abandoned. A new film by Austrian director Friedrich Moser, A Good American, tells the story of the mathematician many consider the best codebreaker the U.S. has ever had, and how he and a small team in the NSA created ThinThread. The program could pick up any electronic signal on Earth, filter for terrorist activity, and render results in real time, thus avoiding data overload, which has been a life-threatening impediment to national intelligence agencies. ThinThread protected Americans' privacy by using an anonymizer so that identities were only revealed after a court warrant was obtained. In a secret test run in early 2002 of ThinThread against the pre-9/11 NSA database, the program quickly detected the terrorists' plans. Joining us from Paris now is Director Friedrich, or Fritz, Moser. Fritz, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
How did you become interested in the topic of your film, namely ThinThread and Bill Binney?
I had been working on a project about the business of surveillance since late 2010, early 2011, and I was following the story of a German hacker who had helped the democratic movement in the Arab Spring when he bumped into surveillance software illegally exported from America to Syria. And then he and friends of his started to scan the internet of traces of this program and came across that basically that program, it was called Blue Coat, was present in all the major dictatorships, but also in most of the European countries. And when we were about to get the financing together and when we were pitching this project and about to start to go into production, the Edward Snowden story broke. And of course, there it became clear that the revelations that Snowden was giving were just dimensions bigger than the story that was following. And it was also clear that Laura Poitras would make the film about the Snowden story. But my background, my academic background, is contemporary history. And so I was interested, how could it happen that we, from the Cold War, when all the intelligence gathering was mostly focused on our military enemies, let's say communist countries, but specifically the Soviet Union for us in Europe and the Red Army and the Warsaw Pact, how did it happen that the focus shifted so dramatically that they weren't spying on our enemies, but on ourselves, so that we had actually become the enemies? And I was going through the list of interviews that I had for this previous project, and Bilbini was on the list. And I thought it would be very interesting to have this change that happened since the Cold War until now portrayed in the story of, in the personal story and in the career of one person. And Bilbini seemed to be the person because he had worked for the American intelligence services since the mid-60s, and then he had become a whistleblower. So there must have been a story of change in his own life. And so I asked him if he would be up for this, and he said, yeah. And so I had him come over to Vienna. This was in October, late October 2013. And we made a series of interviews and background talks. And when he told the story of Finnfred for the first time, I went like, holy shit. It's unbelievable that this story has not been told. I actually asked him and said, Bill, why has this entire story never been told sufficiently? And he said, you know, nobody asked me. And this is very typical of Bilbini. He's just so decent and modest and doesn't brag about things that he has invented and done.
Well, tell us the story. You tell it in the movie, but we're not able to see the movie until April. But we'd like to know what Bill had to say in the movie. What is the story that he tells?
Well, the movie actually works on several layers of stories. And the main storyline actually goes from the World Trade Center bombing in 1993 to the, to the aftermath of 9/11 in 2001, 2002. And that's the story that actually kicks off the hunt for terrorists in the for the intelligence services. And they had to devise a tool, and Bilbini came up with some ideas. Here we go into his backstory. Bilbini came up with a specific angle on how to tackle the problem of surveillance based on metadata, because he, in his own career, very early on in 1966, had come across a way to hack the Soviet Union's command and control system based on metadata. And this allowed him to become sort of the master of prediction within NSA. All his work based on metadata, basically 20, 30 years before the term was invented. At the time, it was called the externals of the communication. And I found this very interesting for two reasons. The first reason was it actually showed that he was very much ahead of his time in terms of how he would tackle problems. But it also allowed me to describe metadata in a very tangible way in the of the old analog days, when it was not just bits and bytes, but you had like real communication that was intercepted. You had places and all of that within the broadcast spectrum. Yeah, so that when they were using this huge broadcast antennas propagating the radio waves all over the planet. So it was easier to describe how and why they were intercepting things, what would be the real interest in those interceptions. And then, of course, it was linked to something very clear, which was military movements, situations of military conflict, of military threats, situations of war that are very, very tangible. Whereas what is happening now in the digital age, it's all very abstract. And this is also why it makes so hard to motivate people to first understand it really what's happening there, but then also to take action. Because I think for the average person, it's very hard to really grasp how deep and intrusive the form of mass surveillance is that we are facing now. So I found a way to describe surveillance as such in the analog age, by terms and standards and images that everybody understands.
And what I got from the film, I thought you did a really wonderful job of distilling complexities into a way that we could understand, is that one of the greatest obstacles in national security intelligence gathering in this country and predicting of terrorist or prospective terrorist attacks is the glut, the overload of information. And what Bill has done is develop algorithms that, as he described it, essentially map all relationships between everyone on Earth in real time, but are able to come down to five I think, series of patterns that he found have been accurate predictors of terrorist activity.
Bill, when he started to work on metadata, what he found out is that in the metadata, so in the communication, he could find patterns. And these patterns were structured based on mathematical principles. And based on those patterns and those mathematical principles that he could find out, he managed to reconstruct the way the communication took. And he also saw that specifically, so this is something that he found out in 66, 67. Then in 68, and he was working on the Soviet Union, in 68 you had the invasion of Czechoslovakia when the Russian troops were hitting down on the democratic movement back then, which was called the Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia. And he saw that the patterns in the communication that the Soviet military was using were changing. And this is when he saw the difference between a training, a military training, and a real military event. And it's not just that he saw these patterns as it happened. He saw it before it happened, because you have planning. You have planning that needs to be carried out. So, and this is something really, really important in order to understand intelligence and also why we have these problems today. The first thing is, intelligence needs to be come across before the event happens. And the more before, the earlier before the event happens, the better it is, because you can react. And in Bill's personal story, it's a story that is not really in the film, but that we just touch a little bit upon, is in the Yom Kippur War, he came across patterns that the Soviets were about to engage in the war. And this actually, in the end, led to America intervening with the Israeli forces in order to not completely annihilate and destroy the Egyptian forces. And this actually led into the peace process in the Middle East. That is something that we have to think about. You know, the outcome can be the positive thing about intelligence is that you have knowledge about somebody's intentions and capabilities, and you can intervene early on. You don't need to go to war. You can intervene diplomatically, and I think this has completely gotten lost in the past decades. This is not what we are talking about, but this is something we should be talking about, especially if we look, for instance, at the conflict in Ukraine with the Russians intervening there. So that's one thing. So to be informed as early as possible. And of course, in the Cold War scenario, this was relevant because you only had 30 minutes to react once a nuclear missile was fired. So if you already know about the other side ramping up in order to fire a missile, you can intervene diplomatically and calm down and cool down a conflict before it really gets huge and out of control. And I think this is something that was very formative for Bill. So when we came to the digital age and to the asymmetric threats after the fall of the wall and after the end of the Cold War, he devised a way to apply the same principles to terrorists, money laundering, trafficking of weapons of mass destruction. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, you had all these brilliant, underpaid engineers being around who were basically up on the free market or on a black market to develop nuclear missiles wherever in the world. And so that's something also that the West was very worried about at the time. So he found a way of, by observing patterns in behavior, basically metadata patterns, in order to predict what people were up to. And this would have allowed agencies or the government or the military or whoever to intervene on time, long before something happened. So in the military scenario, Bill discovered that through the observation of metadata patterns, you could predict things and you could get really good intelligence, workable, actionable intelligence from that. In the digital age, he applied the same system to watching terrorists and other asymmetric threats to our Western countries. And so the thing about these patterns and metadata is, first, you don't need the content. You don't need to look at it. Second, it can be encrypted. It's about the patterns. It's not about the identities behind the patterns. And the third thing is you can watch it as it flies by in real time. You don't have to take anything in. And these were the three principles upon which Synthroid was based. So basically, you don't get the content, you don't collect everything, you look at the metadata flying by and pick out in a targeted approach based on known targets, those very few targets that were really relevant. So all the traffic will just fly by or flow by just as in on a highway with a speeding camera. You know, the speeding camera sees all the traffic going by, but takes only those who are speeding, means only those who are breaking the rules. This is a very similar concept to what Synthroid was about.
Now, ThinThread sounded so elegant in its construction for the reasons you've just detailed, and yet, as your movie explains, when the new NSA director Michael Hayden came in, he nixed the program and instead awarded a contractor a multi-million dollar award to develop a new program called Trailblazer. Why was that?
The amazing thing about this story, and actually maybe the saddest thing about this Synthroid story, is that it was so brilliant and so cheap and so economic that major business interests in surveillance were threatened by it. And this is why it got deep-sixed.
Yes, and in fact, we've covered the very close relationship between big business and our government's intelligence agencies, where we basically contract out about 70% of their functions.
I would say the case of Synthroid versus Trailblazer was maybe one of the biggest pushes into this direction, into the privatization, the outsourcing of intelligence operations to private companies. And the problem of that is actually you have two competing logics that are inherent. So if you have the logic of the public good, it's not for profit, it's for the public good. If you have the logic of business, it's about making profits. That's the logic behind any business. So if you outsource this to private contractors, you have the profit motive stepping in big time. And for that reason, they don't try to be cheap, they don't try to be efficient, they don't try to be fast, because this all would cap the profits or keeping them from even making some. And so the ratio behind this outsourcing for these contractors, for these companies being operative in that world, is to keep problems going, not solving them, because this would prolong all the contracts that they have. The other thing is to make them as expensive as possible, because this would also up the profits, and to be, in a way, inefficient, maybe just resolve little parts, but not resolve all of it, because this keeps you in the business. And that's hilarious if you think about it. And what this really means, this means basically that they are trading the security of every American, but also any other member of the free world, because all these services, all these intelligence agencies are working together for money. And this is something that is not efficiently talked about.
Well, you do talk about it in your film. You have a segment from Signals Intelligence Director at the time, Maureen Baginski, who, after the attacks of 9/11, made a comment about how this would result in cash infusions to the intelligence agencies. And the heroes, really, of your film, in addition to Mr. Binney, were Thomas Drake, Ed Loomis, a few others, including Diane Rourke from the House Intelligence Committee staff, who then went on to complain to the Department of Defense Inspector General about the mismanagement and waste of taxpayer money related to the Trailblazer. So you really have covered a lot of what we're seeing now, is that brave individuals who do speak out are then targeted by the government and vilified as whistleblowers.
Exactly. I think it was yesterday that Tom Drake's name was published alongside real traitors as being somebody who has done harm to the United States of America, which in fact is not true at all. Tom Drake just pointed at the massive corruption that was involved there. And of course, I mean, these guys were running into major business operations. Trailblazer ended up costing, I don't know, something between, so the official version is something close to $4 billion. There is an unofficial version about numbers around, which says it's closer to $8 billion for basically producing PowerPoint presentations, nothing else. So that's very likely the most expensive PowerPoint presentation made in history. And the cover-up continued and has continued until now. I was really lucky when earlier this year I came across somebody who was writing about this DOD IG report that was actually generated based on a complaint that Binny, Kirk, Beebe at Loomis and Diane Rock had filed with the DOD Inspector General, where he was writing that he absolutely wants to publish this because this is a major story and it has to come out. So I got in touch with him. The name of this person is Patrick Eddington. He is currently a fellow with the Cato Institute working on civil liberties. Before, he was working as an intelligence staffer with Representative Rush Holt from New Jersey. And Pat Eddington told me the Sindred story. So he had access to read the entire report, all the classified parts of the report. And he said, this is a major story. It's very likely the most important story of the decade.
Yes.
There's a lot of things that need to come out. And I think, you know, the same thing goes for Europe. It's not just this is not just an American problem. Knowledge about Sindred was around and has been around and must still be around in the UK, in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, but also in Germany, in Denmark, Sweden, and Norway. Because all these countries were kind of partnering with Bill Binney in the development of Sindred. And this is also very interesting that nobody in Europe talks about it. And to me, and what I want to do with this film is to create the awareness that there is a viable alternative to mass surveillance, which does not intrude in everybody's privacy and is way more efficient and delivers, whereas the mass surveillance that we have now does not deliver at all. And you can see this with all the terror attacks that happened since 9/11, including the last one in Paris. And it's just enormously expensive and intruding privacy big time, because they are actually not caring about security. They are just caring about everybody's dirt under everybody's carpet, be able to blackmail those people.
And as we're seeing in news reports, politicians right now are very quick to criticize civil libertarians and others who are saying exactly what you're saying and urging that we give up privacy protections in the name, once again, of the so-called war on terrorism.
Yeah, but this is actually what the French already did. You know, the French, after Charlie Hebdo, the budget for the French intelligence services was upped by €500 million. And they got legislation that was just, you know, sweeping away civil liberties. They had the power to snoop wherever and whenever and however they wanted. And still the Paris attacks happened. So somebody has to tell me now and all the other people who have some common sense how mass surveillance could possibly prevent terror attacks. It does not. Not at all. So if it does not prevent terror attacks, what is the real purpose of it? And this is where it gets really scary. The purpose of it is social control. That's it.
We couldn't agree with you more, which is, unfortunately, we don't have the time to discuss it now, but I want to ask you, the film is coming out for general release this spring. If listeners are interested in learning more about A Good American, your work, Mr. Binney and all the other fine people who worked on this and who've been vilified for it, is there a website they can go to?
Yeah, we have the website of the film, which is called agoodamerican.org, and we will release, you know, bonus material, teasers for the film, bonus material, also the dates of the theatrical and non-theatrical release, dates of the screenings. We will also try to organize action, political campaigns from that website, starting from that website, because we are in touch with several civil liberties groups who actually want to use the film to change these policies around surveillance, which I find personally very, very dangerous. And it's not that I am against any form of surveillance. I think we need to have intelligence agencies. I think we need somebody to protect us. But the way it's carried out currently is absolutely not the way to do it.
Well, Fritz, congratulations on this truly important film. And we look forward to following the progress of the film and efforts to educate more people about Thin Thread.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Fritz. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
University of Illinois trustees 2 weeks ago agreed to an $875,000 financial settlement with Professor Stephen Salida. Last year, Salida's job offer for a tenured position at the university was withdrawn after he issued harsh tweets critical of the 2014 Israeli assault on Gaza, which caused the death of over 500 children. Under the terms of the settlement, Salida will not get his job back, but will receive $600,000, and an additional $275,000 goes to his attorneys for legal fees. Salida stated after the settlement that the petitions, demonstrations, and investigations, as well as the legal case, have reinvigorated American higher education as a place of critical thinking and rigorous debate, and I am deeply grateful to all who have spoken out. We're joined today by the two leading attorneys in the Salida case, Maria LaHood, the Deputy Legal Director at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Anand Swaminathan of the Chicago law firm Lovey & Lovey. We go now to speak with Anand Swaminathan.
Anand, welcome to Law & Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Our listeners are familiar with this case, so if you will, give us a brief wrap-up of the settlement and how you got there.
So the settlement was an $875,000 settlement, and it is basically a payment to Stephen that is intended to cover his losses. And so there's two important things to know about the settlement. You know, I think one important thing is that for a long time, what we have pursued for Stephen was for him to be reinstated. And we've said that Stephen would be willing to resolve this without seeking substantial financial compensation if they would do the right thing and reinstate him. And obviously that's not the settlement that we have here. And so that's something that people have had a question about. And really the point on that is Stephen reached a point where he no longer wanted to be reinstated there. I mean, the bottom line is that Stephen reached a point when he wanted to move on. He wanted to put this behind him, and he wanted to put the University of Illinois behind him. And once that became the case, it made sense for us to try to do the best we could for him financially so he could have peace of mind for himself and his family. And the settlement here is a very large settlement for an academic setting for a case like this. And we think it's a settlement amount that obviously makes Stephen very happy. He views it as a victory and a vindication. And it's a settlement amount that we think is an implicit acknowledgement by the university that they had violated his constitutional rights.
Yeah, but they did not explicitly do that in the statement that Barbara J. Wilson, the interim chancellor, issued. She said, "The settlement reflects our belief that Dr. Salida and his family should be compensated for the financial disruption they experienced." But they didn't admit that there was any kind of interference with faculty self-governance or with his free speech. They kind of would only say that he needed to be compensated for financial disruption. The poor guy was out in the cold, literally without health insurance or a home for a year and a half, and this is what it comes down to in terms of the university. So there's been a lot of criticism of the university for what it did. The university, according to Chancellor Wilson, only wants to get the AAUP, the Association of American University Professors, censored the university, and their main goal now, they say, is to get the censure lifted. Do you think the censure should be lifted?
Well, I think that's a decision for the AAUP. That's not our call, and I think that's a decision that the folks at the AAUP are really well positioned to make. I think what is important here is that some important precedents were set. I mean, obviously, Stephen won a number of resounding victories during the course of this litigation. The judge's motion to dismiss decision, we think, was very powerful. Obviously, the revelations about the efforts to sort of be secret about the decision-making at the university that resulted in the resignations of the chancellor and the provost, we think, were important developments. And obviously, the censure from the AAUP was extremely important. Probably most important was the amount of support that Stephen received from so many people, so many activists, and so many academics. And we think all of those things were part of sending an important message to try to keep these things from happening again. And we're hopeful that the size of this settlement and all of the support that came along with it will cause administrators to think twice.
Yeah, well said. I totally agree.
And in fact, there have been so many other cases in the last few years, unfortunately, that have resulted in professors being ousted from their campuses with no compensation.
That's right. And you know, part of our hope here is that the use of the FOIA process, the Freedom of Information process, the use of these kinds of constitutional claims as a mechanism will be something that can be a model for others to use as well, and most importantly, a model in which people are able to work with activists and academics to build the support that was crucial to Stephen's victory. And I can't stress that enough. The support that Stephen received was crucial to this victory and the amount of this settlement and the university's decision to pay as much as it did. And so we want to thank all of those people.
Yeah, I think that the justice in this case came in the main from the mobilization of all these forces in support of Stephen. That was the justice. And the message that it sends to any other university administration that might want to trample on the rights like the University of Illinois did. So I think I do agree that this was an unprecedented victory. I can't think of anything more important in academic circles going all the way back to 1967 when they broke the ban on the communist loyalty oath ban in New York in 1967. So it's been a long time since we had a big victory like this. And we congratulate you, Anand Swaminathan, for the great work that you did. I read the papers. They were splendid. And keep causing trouble out there.
Well, thank you. And this is really, as you said, I think this was much more about the support from so many others that it was much more about that than it was about any specific legal brief.
You're too modest, Anand. Thank you so much.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We'll now speak with attorney Maria LaHood.
Maria, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Maria, when the case was settled for a big chunk of money, Barbara J. Wilson, the interim chancellor at the University of Illinois, issued a statement. And in the statement, she said that the settlement reflects our belief that Dr. Salida and his family should be compensated for the financial disruption they experienced. So I read that, and I thought about it for a second, and I realized, you know, it doesn't say anything more. She doesn't apologize for breaching the role of the department in choosing somebody they wanted to hire, academic self-governance. She doesn't apologize for the breach of free speech. She doesn't even mention the American Indian Studies Department and what they did to that. And then she goes on to say, I hope that this settlement will cause the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors, to lift their censure. That's her main interest here. And I wanted to get your reaction to the very narrow position that the university is taking here.
Yeah, I mean, the university has not explicitly accepted wrongdoing here, but the size and nature of the settlement show that implicitly they acknowledge that Professor Salida was wronged. And, you know, from the beginning, frankly, they've said, well, they understand that the process was messed up and wanted to pay him something. I think what this really shows is that this struggle isn't over. This settlement settles Professor Salida's case against the university. It doesn't settle what the faculty are entitled to as far as academic freedom, although it is a victory for academic freedom. There are still policies at the university that need to be addressed, and there are still problems that need to be rectified. It doesn't address what the students are, you know, entitled to as far as the benefit they receive. You know, the issue of academic freedom isn't the only one. There's also shared governance, as you mentioned. And these are things that the university will have to continue to reckon with. And the lawsuit was one component of the campaign, and the campaign isn't over. Not only on behalf of the movement for Palestinian rights, but also for those advocating for academic freedom. But I think we shouldn't also lose sight at what a success this was. The movement had an amazing success. You know, the university was subject to a boycott by over 5,000 academics, including Cornell West and others. You know, there were canceled lectures. There were canceled conferences. 16 departments voted no confidence in the administration. There were many associational and organizational condemnations of the university's actions, including by the AUP, including the censure. So, you know, there has been a call by academics to the AAUP not to lift the censure, and making just these points that it isn't over, that the university hasn't actually addressed its wrongs with the settlement.
Speaking of wrongs, Maria, the American Indian Studies Department at the university is now, as I understand it, just one professor or faculty member. Is that one of the reasons that Stephen didn't want to go back, and what do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that has been one of the biggest casualties. I mean, the program is decimated. People have left to go other places. They were completely disrespected. You know, their academic freedom and was also violated. I mean, it is one of the reasons. This was not the position that Professor Salida had signed up for. This was, you know, if there were to be a reinstatement, this was going to a program that went from, you know, numerous people down to one or part of one or 1.5. That is the reason that we're part of it. You know, part of it, I think, is just that, you know, he felt it was time to move on. And the thing about litigation, you know, it's an arduous process and it's uncertain. You know, you never know what the outcome will be. And like with any settlement, you get certainty and you get closure and you get to move on. And I think there's also the fact that we had a legal victory in the decision on the motion to dismiss, and that stands. You know, the fact that the court found there indeed was a contract. And if there wasn't a contract here, you know, the whole academic hiring process would collapse. That's a victory. And that, you know, stands moving forward for everyone.
And the judge and also said that the case implicated every aspect of the First Amendment.
Right, that Professor Slida's tweets were absolutely protected, and you're right, that they implicated every central concern. You know, they were on an issue of public concern, they were made in a public forum, and the administration acknowledged that it was the content that they were upset with, whether it was the tone or the content, it didn't matter. So moving forward, there has been, you know, there is precedent that has been set about free speech in the academic setting. And we should also remember there was, you know, there was the victory in the FOIA litigation as well. They, you know, the university didn't want to claim that they shouldn't have to release documents because of the burden, and you know, it was embarrassing information, and they lost that. And a lot came out through all of the FOIA requests that there were. So I do think, you know, there is a lot the university has to still reckon with, including the fact that the American Indian Studies program has been decimated and that the faculty lost confidence in the administration through these actions. And just because the chancellor has resigned and the provost has resigned, and prior to that the president moved on and the chair of the board moved on, there are still people who were involved and there are still policies in place that need addressing.
The universities before this case were pretty much successful in carving out a Palestine exception to the First Amendment, which is the title of the report that the Center for Constitutional Rights and Palestine Legal issued. And this case seems to me to be an exception to that exception, just an extraordinary victory for us. But as you say, I agree, it's one step in the right direction, but we have to keep struggling. I think justice comes in the struggle as much as in the victory. I wanted to ask you if you had any other thoughts on the settlement.
It is a victory. It is a victory for the movement, not just for Professor Salida. And I think just because it provides closure on his case against the university, obviously it's not closure on the issue. And that's, you know, not only with UIUC, but also across the board. You know, as you mentioned in the report, I mean, this is happening not to the same degree, all, you know, but all over the country all the time, hundreds of incidents. And, you know, since we've issued the report, so many people have come out with their stories who weren't even coming out before. So the hundreds of incidents is just the tip of the iceberg. And yes, Professor Slida's case was, you know, especially egregious and well publicized, but there are so many instances of universities and other, you know, actors trying to suppress speech that is critical of Israel. And I think we have to also remember that, not to be sidetracked by this suppression, and to remember that what Professor Slida was talking about and what the speeches that people are trying to get out there is about the occupation of Palestine and about the, you know, the human rights violations against Palestinians conducted by Israel. The reason we want to support the movement and fight against the repression of that speech is so that people can talk about these issues, the issues of what Israel is doing in Palestine. And hopefully the settlement also, you know, makes space for that. And I think, you know, continued advocacy also makes space for that. So I think that's probably the most important thing.
Well said, Maria LaHood. And on behalf of all of us at Law and Disorder, we'd like to thank you for your continued legal and political work in such areas of importance.
Yeah, it's been a year and a half, Maria. Congratulations. And we'd like to talk to you again when there's another victory that's coming up. You take it easy.
Thank you both.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Last week, we caught up with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers who were protesting in front of Wendy's Fast Food on 45th Street in New York City, and then they marched over to the Wendy's board meeting. The reason was that Wendy's, along with McDonald's and Burger King, some of the largest fast food outfits in the country, had refused to pay a penny a pound more for tomatoes, thus helping the exploitation of some of the most impoverished agricultural workers in the United States. We spoke with Gerardo Reyes Chavez, who has worked in the fields since age 11, Reyes is one of the main organizers for the coalition and one of the main negotiators with the corporations. And then we spoke with Rabbi Raphael Contraster with Trua, a major Jewish ally of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Give a listen.
My name is Gerardo Reyes Chavez. I am a member of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, a farm worker and an organizer also. We're here today because we are going, this is a protest of Wendy's as part of the campaign for fair food nationwide. That we as farm workers have been organizing since 2001. Until now, we have agreements with 14 different corporations that have committed to pay a little bit more to address the sub-poverty wages that the market helped to create with their incredible buying power by pushing prices of tomatoes, in this case, down. Resulting in stagnant wages for those of us who pick the tomatoes. So we ask for that, and we ask also for corporations to condition their purchasing to the implementation of a list of rights that guarantee that our dignity is protected when we go to work. Among those rights are the right to work free of sexual harassment, the right to work free of verbal and physical abuse, and zero tolerance policies for slavery, sexual harassment, and child labor. Perhaps the most important right of all in the Fair Food Program, it's the right to complain without retaliation, which guarantees that when workers complain, they will not be fired like they used to before, or we used to before the program entered into effect. So the reason for why we choose this Wendy's here on 3rd Avenue, it's because we are going to march from here after this picket is over. We're going to march towards Tryon Partners. Tryon Partners, it's basically a corporation that is directed by Nelson Peltz, the CEO of that corporation. They own about 25% of the shares within Wendy's Corporation. And they are also working to restructure the brand and the image of Wendy's. So we are going to go ask them, because they have, and specifically Nelson Peltz, have a lot of power within Wendy's. And it's their responsibility to use their power within the corporation to help establish communication and eventually an agreement, because they are benefiting directly from the fact that the corporation is profitable, while we are in part subsidizing those profits with lack of payment from Wendy's for the workers that are making that product, that artificially low price that they continue to demand. So we want them to join, and we have been implementing the Fair Food Program in Florida for 4 years. This year, this summer, for the first time, we expanded the protections that were established in Florida to 6 other states. And in this process of expansion, all those protections, it's especially important that corporations that haven't signed but continue to benefit from our sweat sign this agreement. Wendy's is one of the 4 more important brands that others have already signed. So they are the one that's standing in the line of most important from the food, the fast food industry. And we know that if they come to the table, and a few other brands from supermarkets like Publix or Kroger come on board, that's going to influence the way in which other buyers are behaving in front of this invitation to join the program. So what we want is for business as usual to be the old way of doing business. We want human rights to be included as part of the business. And 14 corporations have proven that it is a good thing to do, and it is possible to be successful as a business when you also work to implement something like the Fair Food Program that guarantees the human rights of workers are respected.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Rafael Contrasser. I'm with Trua.
Okay.
Trua is an organization of 1,800 rabbis, and we organize the Jewish community in support of the CIW's campaign for fair food. We've been doing outreach to Nelson Peltz specifically, who is Wendy's major shareholder, for about 2 years, because we believe that his influence could bring Wendy's to the table with CIW. And given that Wendy's market power and the fact that they're an outlier in the fast food industry, they're the only ones who haven't signed, we think that Wendy's joining the Fair Food Program isn't just good for business, but really...
Only ones who haven't signed out of who?
Out of the five major fast food chains in the United States, Wendy's is the only ones who hasn't signed. So... it's something their competitors have done, and we view this as more than just good business practice for them. It's a moral obligation. If a solution exists to injustice and you choose to not be part of it, we think that's a really big problem. It's not like there isn't a solution that the CIWs have piloted. I think for us as rabbis, it's especially important. You know, a lot of corporations talk about how their products are made, and they talk about ethical products, but the people behind the products get forgotten. As a rabbi, I believe, you know, it's not the tomato that's created in the image of God, it's the farm worker. And if there is a solution led by the farm workers to human rights in the fields, then that's something we need to listen to and take part of. It's really great. There's nothing like the Fair Food Program in terms of worker rights and the way of enforcement and the fact that workers are driving the program, educating their peers, and that there's a huge degree of enforcement that we don't see. And so it's kind of remarkable to me that Wendy's continues to be in the past and not join the other members of the Fair Food Program.
Why do you think they're holding out? What is it about?
I don't know. I wish I knew. You know, if I could talk to Nelson Peltz, that would be the question I would ask him. Hillel the Elder says, if not now, when? And for me, the question to Wendy's is, if not now, when? You know, if you have a way to do repair of the world, tikkun olam in Judaism, and there's a solution, you don't have to go looking for it, it's right there in front of you, then it would be really easy to say, okay, this is what we can do. We can make a really tangible change. I first went to Immokalee in 2011, which was right around when the growers signed the Fair Food Program and it was being implemented in the fields. So the CIW talks about the new day dawning for farm workers because of the Fair Food Program. And in my visits to Immokalee, that's been something I've been able to see in real time. So it's not a theory. It's making real change. It's given out, I think, $20 million in four seasons. That makes a real difference in the lives of workers. The Fair Food Program gives out the equivalent of an extra day's wages a week. I think all of us know what we would do with an extra day's wages. And for farm workers whose wages haven't budged in years, that makes a tremendous difference in their ability to feed their families, to save, to be more secure in their lives for work that is incredibly hard and that we all rely on. I go to the grocery store, and many of my tomatoes are from Florida. I get a kick out of buying tomatoes. I shop at Whole Foods, so I make a point of buying Fair Food tomatoes when I'm there to support the farm workers who I've met, who I know are in part of the process of picking those tomatoes. It's not just about buying the right thing, it's about supporting the workers who are behind the products. One of the things that's important to remember, first about organics, is that many of us buy organic products because of our concerns about our own health, but organic products are also better for the workers who are not being sprayed with pesticides. But I also think it's important, you know, organic products often cost more, and that Fair Food tomatoes, being both conventional and non-organic produce, are available to all consumers. So this Fair Food tomatoes are not a luxury item. They are available to all of us when you buy tomatoes from a participating retailer.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.
We'll be right back.